offering mainstream media universities, you could now start to discuss the UFO phenomenon without being ridiculed. Apart from that, it was kind of like an underwhelming experience for those of us that have been studying the phenomenon for years and were looking for some kind of significant disclosure. I mean, there was very little that was done other than just affirm that this phenomenon was real and there was no explanation for it. But I thought it was important for just legitimizing the debate within official institutions so that professors can now start talking about it without being ridiculed.
Well, it was a great observation on your part, Michael. You're absolutely right. It made the UFO field a little more credible than what you and I and others have already believed all our lives. And it added that credibility to it, though they didn't give us much information that we didn't already know.
Yes, that's exactly right. But now it opens the door to people starting to write up papers or delivering conference reports on what they found in their studies into the phenomenon.
You've looked at the Galactic Federation and the Astar Cub Command for some time now. Tell us what they are, first of all, Michael.
Well, you know, these are associations of extraterrestrial life, and it's important to understand that extraterrestrials would organize themselves politically, just as we organize ourselves politically when we reach a certain level of kind of civilizational development. I mean, if you look at our history as a planet, I mean, in terms of like the development of nation states and then the development of international organizations, they followed a certain path. When nation states began to war against each other to the extent that this became dangerous for the entirety of other nation states, then you had these organizations that began to form. I mean, after the Napoleonic Wars, you had the Concert of Europe, which was kind of an informal association, and then you had the League of Nations after the First World War being formed in 1919. So why wouldn't extraterrestrials do the same in terms of them organizing themselves politically? And so that was a question I was very interested in from the beginning, when I realized that extraterrestrial life was real, that they were visiting us, that they were making contact with individuals, with governments, and of course people were seeing them all over the place, that, well, how would they politically organize themselves? So that was a question that I was very interested in from very much the beginning of my involvement in this, but never really found enough information to put it all together in terms of an extended research report or a book. Until recently, that I thought, now we've reached the point where there's just so much information that these organizations exist, and we can kind of get a basic idea of some of the major ones that are influencing us. And so I started to look at the history of it. You know, who was the first contactee that began talking about extraterrestrials being organized in bodies that were interacting with humanity, that had laws of self-governance and rules of intervention, and that we could kind of get an idea of, in terms of multiple reports, not just one person saying that this organization exists or that organization exists, but, you know, are there multiple reports over history? And so I found that there were. That two of those organizations that you just mentioned, the Astar Command and the Galactic Federation, these organizations that were mentioned in the 1950s by different contactees, George Van Tassel, mm-hmm. one of the most famous contactees ever. He was the organizer of the Giant Rock Conventions that had up to 11,000 people attending them during these years that they met. He was talking about the Astar Command in 1952. And then you have Daniel Fry, another classic contactee who was an engineer out at White Sands Missile Range. Yeah, both of these people were very, very credible. They were very responsible people. And Daniel Fry was talking about a Galactic Federation in 1952 as well. So that meant that we have, since that time, multiple reports of these two organizations. And, you know, when you can put it all together, you have a very powerful case that these organizations exist, that they are examples of how extraterrestrials have politically organized themselves and how they're interacting with humanity in an organized fashion.
Why, in your opinion, Michael, is it so important for us to understand the logistics of this organization and regulation?
Well, you know, we need to know what rules they have in interacting with humanity. In the famous Star Trek series, you had the Prime Directive, which was a set of rules describing the conditions by which the fictional confederation of planets that were part of the Star Trek series would be able to intervene in worlds. And we all know the Prime Directive described that there could not be any interference in the development of a kind of pre-warp society. So that's the fictional version. So, you know, why wouldn't an organization such as the Galactic Federation have similar kind of bylaws or rules against intervening and disrupting the development, the natural development of a organization or a world such as the Earth? And I thought that was very, very significant. And so I began to kind of look at that and found that there was actually some of these contactees describing the Prime Directive that the Galactic Federation operated on under. And this was something that what was very intriguing was I found one of the drafts documents of this Galactic Federation, a real-life Galactic Federation. This was something I got from the French contactee, a former archaeologist, Elena Danan. She gave me a draft, or she gave me the Prime Directive that she said belonged to the Galactic Federation of Worlds, the real-life organization. And when I looked at that and compared that with the Star Trek Directive, there was an overlap. There was kind of similar verbiage, and that kind of raised the question, well, is the Star Trek Prime Directive fictional, or was it based on a real-life Prime Directive belonging to a Galactic Federation? And so then I went back and looked at some of the earlier work I had done in examining people such as Bill Tompkins and others, saying that Gene Roddenberry was actually read in to a U.S. Navy secret space program that was working with an organization such as the Galactic Federation. And so you kind of put two and two together, and you realize that people like Roddenberry that came up with concepts such as the Prime Directive and his fictional association of worlds were actually being inspired or actually being given real-life documents that were very similar to an actual Galactic Federation that exists today.
Do you have any doubts of its existence, Michael?
I don't, just because there are multiple reports going back to the 1950s. As I said, you can begin with Daniel Fry, George Van Tassel, and then you go throughout the history over the subsequent seven decades, and there are multiple sources talking about these organizations, the Ashtar Command, the Galactic Federation, and the Confederation of Worlds, or Confederation of Planets. Multiple sources talking about these, giving us an idea of different organizations out there that are intervening with humanity. And it makes perfect sense, because we know from our own history as a planet that as you develop politically, you go from, say, a city-state to a nation-state, and then you go to a kind of an international organization such as the League of Nations and the United Nations. Well, it makes a perfect sense that extraterrestrials would have a similar kind of development. And here we have contactees saying that they had interacted with representatives of these different organizations, and they described how these different groups were organized politically, how their bylaws, their rules, and their field of operations, and how it was that they'd been helping humanity. So, yeah, I don't have any doubt that extraterrestrials do organize themselves politically, that this is just a natural flow of kind of like history, whether we're talking human history, galactic history, that extraterrestrials would organize themselves just as we have organized ourselves politically over our historical development.
Okay, Michael, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment and talk about... Welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you along with Dr. Michael Sala. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. One of his books, Galactic Federations, Councils, and Secret Space Programs. Michael, the head of what was called Israel's Space Program, Haim Ished, he's a visiting professor now. He had something to say about the Federation, didn't he?
Well, yes, he definitely created waves when he said, it was around 2019, that the Galactic Federation exists and that it was working with the Donald Trump administration, and that Trump had been told by the Federation that it was too early yet for the Federation to reveal itself to humanity. Because humans still needed to develop sophisticated technologies so that they wouldn't be overwhelmed when the Federation would reveal itself. Quite a remarkable statement, that if anyone else had said it would have been ridiculed, but because Professor Ished, he was the actual founder of Israel's spy satellite program, and actually ran it for close to 30 years, meant that this was someone who was in a position to know whether or not extraterrestrials do exist. I mean, he ran the equivalent of the National Reconnaissance Office for Israel. And so if there was something happening in space, he would know about it. So his admission was, as I kind of said, just part of a long series of people describing this organization, going all the way back to 1952 when Daniel Fry talked about the Federation existing, and there are this kind of sequence of people saying that this organization has been interacting with humanity, trying to prepare us for some kind of a big reveal, and that we aren't quite there yet, or that there have been certain limitations, which kind of fits into this idea of, you know, we discussed earlier, the prime directive, that organizations like the Galactic Federation, they wait for a civilization like our Western civilization on Earth to reach a certain level of ethical and technological development before they reveal themselves. So I thought that was very significant because...
Oh, huge. Huge, Michael. Indeed. What is the Confederation of Planets, and how does that differ from the Galactic Federation?
Well, the Confederation of Planets is another organization, and this one I traced back to 1959, Gabriel Green, who was a famous UFO researcher, activist back in the 50s and the 60s and 70s, and he was someone that began talking about a confederation of planets, and he was active with another individual by the name of Robert Renault, who also talked about this. And the way they described this confederation of planets was that, in contrast to the Galactic Federation, which was a kind of much more hands-on organization, similar to the Ashtar Command, that would militarily intervene in a galactic conflict if they had the right conditions for intervention. The Confederation of Planets was more a spiritual organization that would actually intervene behind the scenes rather than directly intervene militarily in a galactic conflict. It would do so by having face-to-face interactions with private individuals, sharing information so that those individuals could then help educate the population and raise consciousness that way to develop a more spiritual awareness, because, you know, one of the big problems with the Earth, according to these multiple organizations, the representatives or contactees that have interacted with them, is that they all say that Earth's technological development far outstrips our ethical development, which means that our kind of ethical, spiritual awareness needs to develop more. And so an organization like the Confederation of Planets tries to help educate and awaken humanity to what is happening in the cosmos, but also getting in touch with more spiritual concepts like what is it to be ethical, what is it to be of service to others rather than being of service to self, these kinds of concepts which are introduced by groups such as the Ra material, the Law of One material that was introduced from 1981 to 1984 by Professor Don Elkins and Carla Rueckert in the famous Ra material. So that's another example of this Confederation of Planets helping promote awareness. It's a very significant in the Americas, in South America in particular. There's an organization.
Michael, we're losing you on the phone a little bit.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
Okay. In South America, there's also an organization called Mission Ram, which also talks about the Confederation of Planets. And I actually traveled down to South America. I went to Peru a couple of times and did a retreat with one of these groups, getting people to prepare for contact with the Confederation of Planets. And for them, it's all about spiritual development. They do meditations, they kind of like introduce people to galactic history, get people to feel comfortable with them, and that they believe are the conditions by which you can then have sightings and people have face-to-face meetings with the Galactic Confederation.
Let me ask you about this. Mentalist Uri Geller, dear friend of our program, had a mentor who has since passed on, Dr. Andrea Puharic. And Dr. Puharic taught him a lot of things about mentalism and things like that. But was he involved in these ETs somehow?
He was, actually. A very fascinating case. I mean, Andrea Puharic, he was a researcher into psychic phenomena, and he got very interested in this group calling itself the Council of Nine, and that they started to channel information through various psychics. And Uri Geller was someone that was kind of made famous by Andrea Puharic around the world because Puharic wrote the first biography of Geller, which made him an overnight sensation.
Exactly.
In the United States. This is part of our history in the early 1970s. And Puharic started to, and Geller started to get messages from a group calling itself Spectra, which is also another way of describing this Council of Nine. And they describe a group of extraterrestrial visitors that are part of this association of 24 cedar civilizations that helped establish humanity. But if you go back to the work of
we're losing you again, Michael.
Okay, if you go back to the work of Zechariah Sitchin,
mm-hmm.
He talked about the Anunnaki, and he said that the Anunnaki were this organization that helped seed humanity. Well, according to the information that Uri Geller got, there were 24 civilizations doing this. And so Geller, along with Puharic, and then others, such as Phyllis Schlemmer, that also began to channel the mind, got this information about this cedar association of races that were responsible for seeding humanity 500,000 years ago and that have been monitoring us ever since.
Amazing, amazing. Now, what is also called the cedar extraterrestrial races? Who are they?
Well, they are these extraterrestrials that have been involved in establishing humanity as a specific set of genetics that are part of our kind of historical evolution. If we go back to,
like the Anunnaki?
The Anunnaki would be one of those groups. Another group would be the Syrians, Syrian extraterrestrials. Patricia Corey is another. I know you've had her on Coast to Coast. She's also talked about the Syrian High Council, that they're also part of this one of these Theta extraterrestrial civilizations. The Arcturians are another group, another extraterrestrial race that are part of these Thetas. And, you know, these are mentioned by different sources, but when you put it all together, there appears to
be... You're fading again, Michael.
Oh, okay.
What are you doing?
Oh, I'm not actually doing anything with the phone.
Really? Hey, you pop in and pop out. That's interesting.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll just move the phone. It's just a landline. So hopefully...
I mean, now you sound great.
Oh, okay, great. So, yeah, so there's this historical evidence that we have these multiple extraterrestrial cedar races that have been interacting with humanity. And there's a really fascinating case from 1969, a French contactee by the name of Robert L. I mean, he hasn't revealed his full details because he is still concerned about consequences for coming forward. But in 1969, he spent a full year at a secret extraterrestrial base in the Himalayas with a group calling itself the Intergalactic Confederation, and that they also described themselves as part of this cedar group, that they were here, that they were an intergalactic organization, and that they were here to watch over the development of the human genome, and that they were extracting human DNA for another experiment on another world in another galaxy to set up a new Eden. So, you know, this is another example of how these cedar races are very interested in not only helping nurture and help humanity evolve, but also in using our DNA for seeding other worlds in other galaxies.
Tell us about the case of a Robert L. This is a fascinating story.
So, yes, this was that individual that I just mentioned, Robert L., he spent a whole year in the Himalayas with this cedar group, and that they were the ones that were partly responsible for the development of the human genome going back 500,000 years. So Robert L. is one of the latest cases describing this, and that there are more recent examples of this as well, of the extraterrestrials that were responsible for seeding humanity have been returning recently to our solar system. So this is very interesting, given I've got a number of sources all talking about these cedar races returning into our solar system, and that this was actually anticipated and actually welcomed by U.S. Space Command.
Are they here to help us, or do they have some other nefarious purpose?
They are definitely here to help us. They are a very positive, highly evolved group of extraterrestrials. If you use the Nikolai Kardashev scale of measuring the level of civilizations or extraterrestrial development out there, you know, he distinguished between type 1, type 2, type 3 extraterrestrial civilizations, and you can go to type 4, like type 1 is an extraterrestrial civilization that's mastered energy at a planetary level, type 2 at a stellar level, type 3 at a galactic level, and type 4 at an intergalactic level. Then these cedar races are very highly evolved groups that are type 4 civilizations, and that would be distinguished from, say, other extraterrestrial civilizations that people talk about, such as the Greys, which would be a type 1. The Pleiadians would be type 1, type 2. Then we talk about Sirians, Andromedans, that would be type 3. And these cedars would involve type 3, type 4 civilizations that are part of this intergalactic organization.
Dramatic. Michael, where do people get your book, Galactic Federations, Councils, and Secret Space Programs?
They can go to Amazon.com, and it's available there. Soon it'll be available in international bookstores. It'll be People can just go in and place an order, but for the moment they just go to Amazon or go to my website and they can find the link there to order the book.
You say that Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, might have been given some information from within?
I think Gene Roddenberry was briefed about this intergalactic confederation or one of these organizations such as the Galactic Federation, which is a kind of association of extraterrestrials that is willing to militarily intervene in a galactic conflict. And so when you look at Gene Roddenberry, I mean, Gene Roddenberry, he sat in on some of these early Council of Nine meetings that we mentioned earlier involving Andrea Puharich and Phyllis Schlemmer. In 1975, he sat in and he heard information about this Council of Nine and about the 24 extraterrestrial civilizations. And so he came up with ideas. He came up with a pilot series that actually was the nucleus or was used for the development of the Deep Space Nine series. And he also came up with another pilot series called Earth, the Final Conflict, which talked about the 24 civilizations arriving. And in some of my earlier books, I talked about Gene Roddenberry actually being briefed by the U.S. Navy that there was a secret space program that was being held by these extraterrestrials. And so I think that what happened was that Gene Roddenberry was given briefings that this Galactic Federation does exist, that it has been helping the U.S. Navy since the 1950s in developing a secret space program with the goal of the U.S. Navy's secret space program eventually merging with this galactic association.
Well, that would be dramatic indeed. Michael, we're going to come back and continue chatting and taking calls with you next. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you along with Michael Sala and your calls this hour. Michael, let's talk about Noah's Ark. I've always wondered how this individual could build that ark, grab all these animals and put them on. You think he had ET help, don't you?
I do. I think that there's a lot of data that the ark was in fact a spacecraft, a very large spacecraft that was built with extraterrestrial assistance. Yeah, we know historically that the Sumerians did work with extraterrestrials, and the first reference to a Noah's Ark is the story of Utnapishtim, and he describes an ark being built. Now we know that the extraterrestrials were helping the Sumerians, and so it would make sense that even prior to this great flood that the civilization, the pre-flood civilization, would have been helped by the extraterrestrials. Now, how were they helped? Well, of course, in the story of Utnapishtim and in Noah's Ark, God or the extraterrestrials, they helped by giving Noah information to help him build this huge ark. But what we can infer from the literature, from the sources, is that there just wouldn't have been enough wood and enough capacity to be able to house two of every animal and plant on this ark that was hastily built that would survive catastrophic floods for an extended period of time. And so, well, are there references to some kind of spacecraft? And actually, one of the earliest references to the arcs being spacecraft was by Dolores Cannon in her material in the Convoluted Universe, and I came across some references to these space arcs being used to evacuate a population during a time of catastrophic Earth changes, and so she describes that, that these arcs were used for that. And also, you actually have an example from the remote viewing data that was released by the CIA. They actually had some of their remote viewers, remote view Mars up to a million years ago, and they wanted to find out, well, what happened on Mars prior to the last, prior to its civilization being wiped out. And the remote viewer involved, which was Joseph McMonagall, at the time, he actually described these space arcs evacuating the Martian population and taking them to another planet. And, of course, that other planet was Earth. So there were these multiple references to these space arcs being used to evacuate planets during times of catastrophe. And so I think when we look at the story of Noah's Ark, the story of Utnapishtim, and there are roughly 120 different stories of these arcs appearing in throughout our different cultures all over the planet historically, that these were actually space arcs built with the assistance of advanced extraterrestrials that have these devices ready for evacuating a population at short notice in the face of some kind of life-threatening exigency on Earth.
And because, Michael, we really haven't found where the Ark landed on Mount Ararat. Some people claim that they found pieces of it, but we really haven't found it. Is it possible it was taken?
Taken, or it's being held in some storage facility underground, just waiting for the time when these arcs would be needed. Now, this is one of the things that I found very fascinating in doing the research for the new book, was these space arcs were built a long, long time ago by these cedar races, and that they are here not only on Earth, but in our solar system, and that some of these space arcs are on places like the moon and elsewhere in our solar system, and they're just held in storage for a time like the present. Like there are many sources that describe what happens at the end of a great cycle of 26,000 years. I mean, we have the precession of the equinoxes, but the real story here is that every 26,000 years or so, there are major changes on the Earth, you know, whether it's due to some catastrophic earth changes or because of solar flare activity. Somehow these are interrelated, and that these arcs kind of like spring into action, that they're held in reserve, and they're used to either evacuate a population, or they also have the potential to share advanced technology. This is one of the things that I've learned from one of my sources, who's actually currently serving with the US Army. I've known him since 2008, and he joined the Army, and they actually recruited him because he was an extraterrestrial contactee. They wanted him to join the Army because they wanted him to be part of certain missions. And so he was taken to one of these space arcs buried under the Atlantic Ocean in the Bermuda Triangle area.
Wow.
And he saw it. He's actually been on now three times on this space arc, and he's seen its size. It's very large. He says it's the size of four aircraft carriers. It's a shape that has an oval shape, and that he's been on the one buried under the Atlantic, and he says that there are nine of these that are known by the U.S. Space Command, and that they're working with other countries such as China and Russia to find these space arcs and get access to them, and that these space arcs are linked by an intricate system of portals, space-time portals, and they link the arcs in a network not only on Earth, but also in space and on the moon and other planets in our solar system.
Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Joe, truck driving in Indiana. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Hey, bud. My question would be that with as much turmoil as in the world right now, and the world governments is just totally messed up, if these organizations exist, the alien organizations exist, what's their end game? If any government in the world is working with them, then that can't be good. What's their end game, since there's so much turmoil right now?
What's the end game for the Federation, Michael?
Well, the end game is for people to be prepared for extraterrestrials revealing themselves. I mean, we have had an incredible amount of information coming out over the last few years. People are taking photos, people are taking videos, people are having face-to-face encounters with extraterrestrials. You know, this is being posted all over the internet. You have the U.S. Congress holding hearings. You have academics and the mainstream media finally paying attention to UFOs being real. Of course, what we're getting from the mainstream is that we don't know what they are. But what we do know from multiple sources is that some of these, not all of these craft, some of these craft are actually reverse-engineered spacecraft that are actually being deployed by U.S. Space Command and the equivalent in China and Russia. But also, many of these craft are actually extraterrestrial spacecraft that are visiting us. And the end game is for humanity to be ready to welcome these extraterrestrials and to become part of this kind of intergalactic community. And very interestingly, the Star Trek series is part of the preparation. And it's not by accident. In the book, I discuss the U.S. Space Command's forerunner, which was U.S. Air Force Space Command, actually creating a workshop in 2019 that mapped out the future possibilities for humanity in space. And the optimal outcome that they came up with, eight possible outcomes, and the optimal outcome was a Star Trek future. So that was the optimal outcome, and that would be one where humanity organizes itself, and eventually we become... We set up this space organization that is incorporating all of Earth's major spacefaring nations, and we begin to cooperate with other extraterrestrial civilizations in a overarching space organization such as the Galactic Federation. And that is, in fact, I think, what is happening right now.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Brian's with us in La Mirada, California. Hey, Brian, welcome.
How are you, sir?
Great, thank you.
That's great. Long time, first time. So
thank,
I've been
thank you.
To you for a very, very long time, and I was telling your screener that you help a lot of Marines get through long nights, too, because the Marine Corps, we really love listening to your show.
We would love those Marines, even though I was in the Navy, Brian.
Well, hey, we got a great relationship. I love the Navy Corpsmen. Without them, we couldn't survive. So.
That's true.
So, yeah, I guess, you know, I'm listening to the topic, and I'm a believer in the Bible. I'm a believer in Jesus. I'm a believer. I'm a Christian. So I do study the Bible quite a bit. Now, when it comes to Noah's Ark, over the years, as a kid, I saw many shows about have they found Noah's Ark, and it's never been conclusive. Then there's satellite imagery where they think that they found it from space looking at Mount Ararat, and still nothing solid conclusively. But from the story in Genesis, you know, we know that when it settled at Mount Ararat, that's a very high peak. So as the waters recede, and, you know, I'm sure people, they migrate down because they're at a high elevation. It doesn't surprise me that it would be the acacia wood or whatever type of wood it was wouldn't necessarily be held together all these many years later. There would be some erosion and decrepitude. So it doesn't surprise me that it wouldn't be one intact structure with earthquakes and rain and snow and all these different elemental things that would break things down, like natural products or natural fibers or natural wood. Has it, they could, what's the word I'm looking for, like decompose.
Mm-hmm.
So the Ark may not even really have the ability to have sustained itself in that pure form that it once had, just like anything else that would be like a dead piece of wood. It would dissipate or degrade over time. So maybe there's some remnants, but I don't really know for sure in my mind, would there be enough of it to say, hey, that's a boat? you know, if we looked at it today, maybe pieces of it, I would imagine, over that many years.
That's a good point. Let's check in with you, Michael. What if it's just deteriorated and there's nothing there in terms of the Ark? We really can't find pieces of it.
Well, I think, you know, when we're looking at this question of a pre-flood civilization, you know, we need to look at, say, the Book of Enoch, which is part of that kind of Western Judaic tradition, and it describes the fallen angels as these, essentially these extraterrestrials that come and that they disseminate advanced technologies throughout the planet, and that this leads to a conflict with another group of extraterrestrials or righteous angels. So, you know, in the Book of Enoch, you have the battle in the heavens between the fallen angels and the righteous angels led by Archangel Michael and Gabriel and so forth. So, I mean, are we talking about a spiritual war, or were we actually talking about a high-tech war involving advanced technologies that were available to humanity in a pre-flood civilization? And I think when we're talking about a pre-flood civilization, we're talking about advanced technologies that spacecraft were actually common or were being used by some of the civilizations at the time. Atlantis, Plato talked about Atlantis prior to the Great Flood that occurred 9,600 BC. So I think that prior to the Great Flood, there was an abundance of advanced technologies that was used for space travel. And so if Noah was part of that culture, we know that, as was his grandfather Methuselah, and Enoch was his great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. They were part of that advanced technological society prior to the Flood. So to me, sorry, it just doesn't make sense that the Ark was made of wood. I think it was a spacecraft. And I think that spacecraft performed the function that it was set up to, which was to take Noah and his family and the animals and so forth to safety during the catastrophic floods that affected the Earth 11,600 years ago, and to safety. And then humanity would rebuild after that. But the Ark, I don't think it was left on top of Mount Ararat after the waters receded at all. I think it went to whatever safe location. And there's, interestingly, and this is a controversial issue, but I should mention it, near Mount Ararat, Turkey, there is a place called Kherson Sand Flats in southern Ukraine, which is very close to Turkey, and that is apparently where a space ark is buried under the sands.
That would be dramatic, Michael.
Yeah, and one of my sources says that this is an actual space ark that the Russians found there, and that's one of the reasons, one of the factors that led to their incursion into Ukraine.
Michael, how elaborate is the so-called secret space program?
The secret space program, this is something that has been in development since the 1940s. You had the U.S. Air Force being formed and the Air Force taking steps to study and reverse engineer captured extraterrestrial spacecraft. You had the Navy doing the same thing. And so we're talking late 1940s. And we're talking over 70 years of secret reverse engineering. And I think the scientific community that is involved in these deep black projects, officially known as unacknowledged special access programs, these guys worked out long ago, with the assistance of extraterrestrials, how to build some advanced anti-gravity spacecraft, and these spacecraft have been improving and just getting better over the years. So today there is a very powerful, very sophisticated set of spacecraft that have been developed by different nations, Russia, US, China, France, Britain, and even Japan and Israel have all built these secret spacecraft, and that they've deployed them. And US Space Command is now in charge of a international coalition that is working face-to-face with some of these extraterrestrial organizations that I mentioned earlier in the show, Galactic Federation, the Ashtar Command. And this is something that is indicative of humanity. We are actually a type one civilization in terms of what is being secretly deployed in these special access programs, but has not been publicly released yet. But we're very close to that being publicly revealed. This, you know, what we're witnessing right now, I think is like the birth pangs of humanity entering into a galactic community.
Or simply the tip of the iceberg as well. We're going to come back in just a moment and take final phone calls with Dr. Michael Sala in just a